not so many generations ago. Our children would have been born in our beds. A broken leg would have been splintered on the kitchen table. If someone had needed to be quarantined for an infectious disease, they would have been kept in their rooms. Our parents would have grown old around our hearth fire. They and we would have died in our own beds. Not so long ago, the house, the home, was a delivery room, a nursery, a hospital, and a nursing home, and a funeral parlor. And whatever our degree of emotional timidity, each of us would have touched the newborn and touched a corpse. We would have poulticed the wounds and dealt with the inevitable chamber pots. We would have known the cantankerousness and the thankfulness of those who are nursed. We would have known the desperate need and the bitterness of those who are aging. We would have lived a much more involved, entangled life with life itself, with pain and illness and anxiety and birth and death. And we would have been different because of it. Now, I'm not one who believes that the old days are inevitably or necessarily good or better, or that those of an older generation were wiser in certain basic aspects. But surely during those years, we would have been able to handle the crises of life a little more easily than we do now. We would not have been so tempted to run away from tears or bitterness or anger or fear or death. Because if we'd run away, there'd been no one else to handle them. There was a certain dignity allowed to people as they went through the various crises of life, changes of life. They remained themselves, a name, a parent, within the walls, the familiar walls of their room and of their home. Today, as we grow older, we have the professions that heal and care, and we have the institutions which care and nurse, and somehow those whom we send to these institutions to a degree cease to become themselves and become the salt-free diet in bed B in room 202. And as we have moved into this era, this antiseptic era, where all that is painful, all that is to do with invalidism, all that is to do with death is handled outside our home, away from us, professionally. A certain efficiency, certain professional competence has come into these services, which we would not willingly give up. But at the same time, we have grown less able to handle, both as the sick person and as a member of the family, these moments. We're more timid, we're more uncertain, we're more tentative in our relationships. A growing distance between us and our own develops. Parents feel that they are being abandoned, and children feel that they are burdened by the aging of their parents. Children are left in hospitals and away from this familiar and secure surroundings. They get better care, but emotionally it's obviously a more searing and trying undertaking. And so in a strange way, even as life has become easier for us, as so many of these services are taken out of our hands and handled professionally, life has become more difficult for us emotionally, more painful, if you will. And we've been reacting against that. Particularly since the end of the Second World War, most of us have been in one way or another part of a let's get back into life movement. Parents recognized that their children were being raised in homes which, in a sense, bespoke a lie about life. They were so clean, so full only of the happy moments, so innocent of death and anxiety and age and illness and pain, that our children were growing up frightened by the inevitable changes that they would have to undergo in life, and all those whom they knew would inevitably undergo. And so we began to see fathers going into the delivery room with their wives. We began to hear of hospitals putting beds in children's wards so that the mother could stay there overnight and give the warmth and the security that she alone could give. In a number of countries, they began to develop hospices, places which were institutions but yet warm and open, where those about to die could go to die, surrounded with their own furniture, their own knick-knack, able to be visited at any time by their family, able to eat anything they could possibly consume. The series which we held this fall, which we called Coping, was part of this whole movement which has been afoot now for perhaps a generation, which all of us have tried to understand something more of the psychological and emotional needs which surround us, psychological and emotional needs which we have overlooked as we became efficient and more medically competent and more capable of creating the nursing institutions and the caring institutions in our society. We dealt this year with the question of death and with dying. And we found that those who came to the Coping series came in part because it dealt with a subject which had been somehow taboo to them. It's surprising in our society how many who are otherwise quite competent, competent professionally, competent in a worldly sense, how many are still like children when it comes to dying and to death. They're like the children, who have to hold their breath and close their eyes until the car has made its way past the cemetery. It's surprising how many of us who are otherwise competent have avoided making a will. It's surprising how many more of us who are otherwise competent have never discussed death and dying, our wishes, and more importantly, the responsibilities that will remain to the one in the family who will survive. I'm struck always how often I go into a home shortly after a death and someone there says to me, my husband, my wife never talked these things over with me. We've made no provisions. Where do I begin? What do I do? And the questions that are raised have to do with business and with responsibility, but also with the funeral itself, whether to bring children or not. These are moments that are going to face all of us. And we don't delay the moment at all by a superstitious fear that somehow by talking about death, we're somehow going to hasten its arrival. The old Jews had a phrase, "Al tiftach peh l'satan," don't open your mouth, let Satan be let in. But that's nonsense. It's a superstition. It's part of an old world which we should long since have outgrown in our modernity. I suspect, however, that most of those who came to Coping were not of this avoider type. They avoided Coping, though the attendance was quite high. But I do think that Coping had the value of what I would call a wave effect, that it started people talking about the questions of dying and death, and I found here and there over coffee and even over cocktails, people were coming up and asking questions which suggested they had been thinking about it, even though this wasn't a normal kind of conversation for them. They said to me, for instance, "Rabbi, what does Judaism believe about immortality?" Which I confess, I translate immediately to mean, "Rabbi, what's going to happen to me when I die?" We pushed the question away, but at least we were beginning to realize that it had to be surfaced and had to be dealt with, and that's all to the good. Most of those who came, and most of us, are children of an age which has heard a lot of great deal of talk about death and of dying. There have been a number of books written, as you know. And we're trying to understand just how the older practices and the newer knowledge fit together. We're trying to make up our own mind what we feel about funeral practices, about cremation, about the visits after a death. We're trying to understand our own feelings about death, dying, immortality, the future, what lies beyond the grave, if anything lies there. And it's good in this sense to put this movement into some kind of perspective, chronological and otherwise, and try and understand really where we are and what we're asking. About 15 years ago, questions of death and dying emerged from those issues which somehow nice people never talked about openly to become issues of public concern when a number of writers, Mrs. Mitford and others, began to talk about the high cost of death. And you remember how in a number of books on the American way of death, they talked about forest lawn and the black sleek hearses and the carpets of flowers and the unctuous bevy of black-suited funeral attendants. And they equated American funeral practices with the American prosperity, with conspicuous consumption. And they raised up in our minds, however superficial these books were, and they were in fact superficial, for they dealt only with the economics of the issue. They began to raise in our minds questions about the value of the funeral itself, about the cost of a funeral. And out of these books and the discussions that came from them, there emerged in most of our communities memorial societies, which were designed to provide a quick disposal of the body. The body would be picked up and would be simply cremated. And then if the family needed some kind of public acknowledgement of the death, there could be at some later date a memorial service. Now this certainly solved the problems of economics, of cost. Whether in fact it solved the number of emotional needs, spiritual needs which face us when we face the trauma of a death of someone we love desperately is another question. That was the first of the building blocks of our current concern. And I suppose it's only natural that as people who are part of a capitalist society, our first issue should be economic. And they remained economic because the next set of issues that emerged had to do not with the high cost of death, but with the high cost of dying. As medicine multiplied its miracles, it became more and more possible, it became more and more routine for people to take a lot of time to die. And there was a question that emerged now for the first time is, when does death intrude? I remember that one of the first emotional crises that I faced when I came back to the temple 20 years ago had to do with a grand old lady. She was in her middle 80s. She was one of the most lovely and lovable women I've ever known. And she fell ill with pneumonia, which was up till recently called the friend of old age, because it was the way that the elderly tended to die. But she was filled with the antibiotics, the new miracle drugs, and she survived, but her brain didn't. And there she was, beloved by her children, her grandchildren, by a community. And she remained and she was kept in this comatose state for nearly 2 years. 2 years in which the great love, admiration, and respect of the family was overlaid with frustration and anger, because the cost in part of keeping this wonderful woman, now a vegetable really, quote, alive, unquote, took away all the hard-earned surplus by which the two children had hoped to provide for their old age and their retirement. And all of us in one way or another have faced this question of the prolongation of death and the high cost of dying. And out of these questions, there emerged the right to die movement. And most importantly, there emerged a need to redefine death. To define death not simply as the pulsation of the organs of the body, the heart and the lungs, but somehow as brain death. That when the mind, the intelligence, consciousness has been washed away, the electrical current no longer is there and we have no mind anymore, but somehow, in fact, we are dead. But that too raised a whole series of emotional and psychological problems for us. Because now, for the first time, someone must sit often and make a decision. A decision which we tend to phrase, shall our husband, our wife, our parent live or die? Shall we treat them or shall we not treat them? Shall we tell the doctor to perform certain operations or shall we tell the doctor not to perform certain operations? And there's no more cruel or bitter position for anyone to be in than that. Having faced the high cost of death and the high cost of dying, and having recognized that the issue was not purely economic, though it began obviously for economic reasons, surfaced for economic reasons, many of us as Jews recognized that there was a third problem for us. The aesthetics, the cultural milieu in which we live had changed. And many of us were increasingly finding the old way of, old Jewish way of dying and death, the old Jewish funeral, somewhat excessive, a bit florid. We found those lengthy eulogies praising a very ordinary human being to be a bit much. We found it difficult to imagine what was the virtue to feeding everyone who came to a funeral when they returned to our home after it. We began to wonder about the professional wailers and mourners. A number of questions emerged among us as to the virtue of the old patterns, and these too have to be dealt with. And it was trying to understand all of these phenomena, the old and the new, that I think brought most of us to these series of sessions on coping. And hopefully we emerge with some synthesis of ideas which will be useful to us. Let me tell you where I am and what I believe. Each of us will make up his own mind, but I deal with death and dying, with grief and funerals and mourning a great deal. First of all, I think it's important to recognize, and I recognize it even more clearly as we went through these sessions, that with us, with Jews, the funeral is not a sacrament. It is not prescribed by the Torah. That is, its forms are not prescribed by the Torah. It is an observance which has taken the shape of those who needed it at a particular moment in time. I hope you were struck, as I was struck, by the fact that the Bible, the Torah, makes no specific prescription requiring stipulates the exact form that a funeral should have. All that we have in the Torah are certain rules and regulations which prohibit excessive grief. You're not to cut your skin. You're not to pull out your hair. You're to provide an appropriate funeral, yes. But the form of the funeral is not prescribed. And that form has changed in Jewish life from age to age. Our biblical ancestors would take the corpse and they would lay it in the opening of a family funeral cave. And once the body had decomposed, the bones would be picked up and brought together and simply put in a niche in the back of the cave. That was the cave of Machpelah, of Abraham our father, in which he first placed Sarah, in which all the patriarchs were placed, and the form of worship which was engaged, form of funerals, the object of the funeral as it was designed in those days. There was a procession to the cave. As they went along, they recited kinot, or lamentations. But the funeral obviously was not the kind of funeral with which we are familiar. And in later times, as the belief in resurrection became more important among us, In rabbinic times, a funeral took a different form. The body was placed upon a simple plank or in a simple wooden coffin and actually buried in the ground. It would decompose dust to dust and ashes to ashes. And a very sophisticated ritual was established, which had to do with the 3 intense days of mourning and the 7 days of being at home, the Shiva, and the Shloshim, a period of 30 days of lesser mourning, and the year during which you recited the Kaddish, and the Yahrzeit, the anniversary on the death in which you recited the Kaddish. Here the great hope was in the physical resurrection of the body, and so the emphasis was placed upon the actual interment of the body, so the bones would all be in place. Well, today I suspect that we, most of us, have no great belief in the physical resurrection of the body. If we believe in anything beyond this life, it's some kind of immortality of the spirit. And obviously there is less concern for the actual physical survival of the bones in some kind of container. And so the possibility of cremation, of a new form for the funeral, is not so startling or shocking to us. And we've also recognized, I hope, that the funeral exists not for the dead, but for the living. If it were only a question of the dead, we do not need a funeral. We don't need a funeral to bury their ghosts. We keep them firmly in the ground. We don't need a funeral and the rites which accompany a funeral in order to hasten their spirits into heaven. When my father died, I didn't recite the to speed his soul into heaven. He didn't need my prayers to be welcomed by the God whom he'd served all his life. A funeral exists for the living. And funerals exist in every culture that man has ever uncovered because the living need them. Because we need an appropriate moment of farewell. Because we need a moment in which we draw close around us the ties of family to fight the sense of loss and of loneliness which overwhelms us when someone who has been central to our lives is suddenly taken away from us. And because we need to admit that we have faced death, that our lives cannot be the same, that something lacking in our lives, and we've got to begin to remake our lives without the security of a parent, without the love of a husband or of a wife, or without the love that we can shower upon a child. A funeral exists for the sake of the survivors. And that's why it's so important to recognize in this day when we tend to be a little bit cavalier about emotions and feelings, particularly about rituals and observances, that we have emotions and feelings. They need often to have outlets and to be structured into certain forms, and why it's so important to have a funeral. Let's look then at cremation, which will be the way of the funeral in the future. About 1 in 20 of the services which we now have here within the temple family involves a cremation. Certainly within a generation, that number will increase. It will increase because of cost. It will increase because of concerns for land use. It will increase most of all because we have outgrown the need to feel that the bones must be there in order to guarantee immortality for those whom we love. But even as we move towards a society in which cremation will be the normal way of disposing of a body, certainly we have to remind ourselves that there is an appropriate way to cremate, that we simply don't have someone pick up a body at the hospital, let's say, and truck it off with a dozen other bodies to the local crematory and let its ashes mix with the ashes of whatever's in the oven. Certainly, most of us need to feel that we have accompanied those whom we loved to their final end with as much love and care as we've accompanied them throughout life and as they have accompanied us in our lives. And more than this, there's a need for us to sense the fact that they are dead. I have a great problem with the memorial societies because I have a great problem with the memorial service as such. A memorial service is not unlike this. You come, you sit in a room, there are a few prayers, perhaps a few words said about the dead, there's some flowers in front of you. But there's nothing to signify death, to symbolize the particular death. We're creatures of sense. Everything we know comes to us through one of the five senses. And until we see something or can taste it or can touch it, somehow it's not real to us. If someone is suddenly killed by an accident far away from home, again and again I found that those who are here, who hear of the accident, have to go down and see the corpse when it's brought here in order to convince themselves that that person is in fact dead. The news isn't enough. And that's true equally of a memorial service. It's not enough. You somehow need the presence of the coffin and the corpse, or the presence of the urn and the ashes. Some very visible focus, something that you see, which you can't deny, because denial is the great emotion that takes over at a time like this. He's only gone. She's away. The word is, he's dead, she's dead. They will never come back to us in the here and now. And until we can say that, until we're forced to say that, the path of and the progress towards rehabilitation, towards the restructuring of our lives around the new set of relationships, the new reality, does not begin. Cremation then faces us with the responsibility, if we're in fact going to go that way, of carrying it out in some way which allows us to have the funeral service as such, and after the service allows us to have a place which will forever after be associated in our minds with the dead. That's the only virtue of a grave site. Here's a place where we can come and focus our thoughts and focus our memories. Now, obviously, you can think about the dead person anytime, and you often do. Even as you can pray any place, you don't need a synagogue to come to pray. But something about the synagogue helps you to focus your prayers, to bring them to the surface. And something about a grave site helps you to focus your memories, to bring them to the surface. I spend a good bit of time in Mayfield Cemetery. And more often than not, when I'm there, I see here and there around the cemetery a husband, a wife, a parent, a child standing quietly beside the grave. They're speaking whatever they're speaking in their hearts. But the fact that there is a place associated intimately, physically with someone they love is obviously a benefit to them. And so if we're going to cremate our dead, let's not adopt the cavalier American attitude of taking their ashes and strewing them abroad. And somehow that corresponds to, you know, don't fence me in, let me wander over yonder. Let's place the ashes in an urn, as the Chinese and others did with their immemorial wisdom. And let's place the urn in a family plot or in a columbarium, some place which will forever after, in our minds, through our senses, be associated with us, with them, be the place where we come to speak what is in our hearts. We have to somehow wed the old and the new reality, the old wisdom and the new reality. And we have to do it as intelligently as we can. The funeral exists for us. The rites of the funeral exist to be of benefit to us. Now, as we move into this new age, more and more people have tried to be rather offhanded about emotions. We do not handle emotions well. That's one of the hallmarks of our age. We're trying again, most of us, to try to open up to recognize that we live with people and among people, that we should have an I-you relationship, an intimate relationship with all kinds of people. But to do so, you must dare to feel. You must be willing at times to be hurt because of those feelings. We do not handle emotion well, and we're going to begin, hopefully, to learn how to handle it. But if we're going to do so, let's be careful about the way in which we handle the emotions of grief, the emotions which survive with us when someone close to us dies. Most of us, I'm afraid, would like to get the whole thing over. It's just too difficult. We don't want to have to try and come to grips with what's surging within us. It's better to try and keep it down, keep it moderated, modulated. And so we don't want a lot of people coming into our home. We don't want to have to think of a 7-day ritual of Shiva. We want to get back to work. Someone's told us someplace about the value of being back in our routines, and there is value in that. But there's also, my friends, great value in friendship and in family. There's great value in the coming together of all the generations. Somehow, when someone dies, a child playing underfoot is one of the greatest of therapies that there can be. The next and the next generation coming behind. But more importantly, what is the hurt of death? We know that someone we loved no longer has pain. Death is not pain, but the cessation of pain. We cry that their lives were abbreviated, but we know that they're at peace. We're the ones who are hurt. And in what does our hurt consist? That we've been abandoned. That someone we've depended on has left us. More often than not, I hear a widow say, "How could he do this to me?" We've been abandoned. We are alone. And we're facing the most bitter of all human feelings, loneliness. And what do we need more than anything else in a lonely time? Friendship. Swarmings of people. The sense that we're not alone. That though that particular intimate relationship is no longer ours, there are many other relationships which are in fact ours and remain ours. That we're part of a community. And the community can no longer be in our society simply our families. Because we live in a mobile society and most of our children are someplace else. Neighbors and friends, these in a very real sense are our family today as we grow older. We see our children only occasionally. We need to depend upon our friends day by day by day. We need to have a chance to let them come in. So why in the name of heaven? That sign that I hear, see again and again in notices with increasing frequency, no visitation. No visitation. What does it mean? Well, occasionally it means that there is no one left in the family. There's no one to visit. Well and good. But more often than not, what it means is simply this. I've been hurt. I really don't want a lot of people trampling in my home. My boy's going to be back from the East Coast for a couple days. I want to keep him to myself and hug him there as long as I can. And what happens when we put the no visitation sign on? Well, usually what happens is we assume that our good friends will pay no attention to it. But if they're good friends, they're precisely the people who will pay attention to it. And then we become angry with the friends, the very people whom we need the most desperately. The no visitation sign, my friends, is an impossible one for anybody to know how to react to. Who's included and who's excluded? Rabbi, why didn't you come to see me when my father died? He He died. He was a member of another congregation. Why didn't you come? Well, I saw the sign, no visitation, but I wanted you. How do I know that? I can't read what's in someone else's mind, nor can anyone. And more often than not, I'm afraid that these kinds of signs are simply statements of our own emotional timidity. We're afraid. We're afraid we're going to cry in somebody's presence. We're afraid we're going to say something excessive. We're afraid to show that we really feel what we really feel. We want to keep it down. So concerned at how it'll look. We've also been put off from time to time when we've been to some Shiva, some visitation, where the cultural background, the people were different than ours, and somehow it was very noisy. It becomes something of a party. Well, there's one very easy way to keep Shiva from becoming a party. You don't have to serve. You don't have to open the liquor chest. People come, and they visit. And you're drawn back, inevitably, into the community. As you know, I wrote about this in the last issue of the Temple Bulletin. And after I wrote, a number of people were kind enough to respond, and I'd like to read briefly part of one response, obviously because it agrees with me. But it's important. It's important because the experience indicated suggests that it's not only my own reaction, but that of many of you. Dear Rabbi, I read in this week's Temple Bulletin your brief essay on visitation after the death of a loved one. I want to commend you upon it. I have my own story on the subject which may interest you. Last year, when my mother died, we placed a no visitation in the papers. My motivation derived from the following thinking. Both of my parents had had long spells of illness. They were very old. Their friends were old and not robust. Their friends had been attentive through the years. Therefore, I did not want to impose a trip outdoors in the cold winter weather upon all those elderly people. I discovered the thinking was utterly faulty. In fact, when I explained the thinking to one of my mother's friends, she said, "We all go out for lunch. We all go out to play cards. Let us decide if we can or want to pay a visit." So you see, I deprived these old friends of performing an ancient ritual, and I deprived our small family of the warmth of a visit from old friends. And also, I really believe that I threw everyone into a state of uncertainty. It's a mistake I'll never make again, and I hope that my children will not make the same mistake when I die. Little by little, as you know, I've tried to talk to you about making minor changes in the patterns in which we deal with grief in the funeral. I've suggested more and more that we move the funeral service to the chapel at the mausoleum, that we avoid the long, pointless ride through the bitter, icy streets from a funeral home to the gravesite. And more that has taken place. I now plead with you that unless there's some overwhelming, extenuating circumstance, that you think through again the whole question of the open home, of the Shiva. You can limit it. The old Jews had 3 days of intense mourning and then the longer 7-day period. If you want, be at home only for the 3 days. But be at home. Let your friends come. Let those who love those whom you loved come, because you're not the only one who loved them. And you often don't know of people out there for whom they did wonderful things who also need to come to say what's in their hearts. Let your home be open. It'll help open your heart. It'll help unblock your feelings. But more than anything else, that's the therapy for grief. God gave us tears to cry, to unblock the pressures within. God gave us a voice, the facile mind, to find words, rationalizations, which will somehow help us through a difficult period. God gave us arms to throw about each other and hug each other. Those are the ways in which we begin to move beyond grief. The open home, the open heart, the opening of our feelings. I hope in the years ahead, we're going to have other such moments as this coping series, chances over a period of time to deal with the emotions and the realities which surround the crises of our lives. I'm going to suggest that we have next year a coping series on aging and the aged. Surely that is one of the most critical of the problems that face us. More and more, I think we need to come together to draw on our ancestral wisdom and to come together to try and work through all those developmental stages of life, which no family escapes, which if we live long enough, each of us undergoes, and which we need to know how to face and how to handle in our own very special age. Amen.